Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, a podcast which is normally a monologue in which I talk about literature, philosophy, and the history of how we know things. But this podcast is part of a series where I release conversations that I've had with people on Twitter Spaces. If you don't use Twitter or you don't use Twitter Spaces, this is just a way of hosting a live audio conversation on the internet. By default, it has a sort of host with an audience and you can invite people on stage. So this is an experiment in releasing some of those conversations which have just been sitting on my hard drive until now. So I hope you like the conversation that we had and I look forward to hearing from you. If you would like to schedule one of these conversations with me, please reach out. I am Brian Cam on Twitter. I'll include that in the show notes. And you can also find a link there to schedule a future conversation with me if you would like to do so. And with that, here's a conversation from earlier this year. So I'm Brian Cam. I'm an independent writer and researcher, and also a big fan of your podcast, Historian Splaining. You are Sam Biagetti, historian and podcast. Would you like to say anything else to introduce yourself?
Well, you know, obviously I'm an American and I have a PhD in early American history that I finished, I guess it was about 7 years ago now. So I've been out of there 7 years and I've, you know, done some of the bouncing around as an adjunct. I'm also an antique dealer. I buy and sell antiques in my area. And I started all of this, you know, in early 2017, basically after I left New York and moved to a small town in New England. And it seemed like, well, if I like lecturing and a lot of people like my lectures, I should just put them online. And actually I should give credit to my friend, Michael Sokolovsky, who said, we should just start a podcast, just record them and put them on a podcast. And I said, yeah, actually that's a good idea. I guess I should try that. So it all kind of started from there.
And yeah, I was curious about how you got into history in the first place. Was that a kind of interest going back to childhood or did you get into it at a certain point?
Well, in childhood, I really loved geography. And I think that there was kind of an evolution where, you know, I was fair enough at math and passable at science, but I just loved looking at maps and knowing where things were and figuring out the different relationships between places and the landscapes and the different groups of people. And then I guess from there, it sort of gradually extended into history, into wanting to know how different people had lived and the things people had done in all of these different places and landscapes around the world. And it built from there. So by the end of high school, it was really history. And, you know, there isn't really a subject of geography in American education. It's not a subject area. It's kind of folded into history, which is part of why I think people find history so confusing, is because they have no visual way to place these things they're hearing about. But I had sort of gotten that just on my own as a hobby before I then went into history.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was reading, I'm trying to think, maybe it was Frank Appan's book, and he was kind of talking about his childhood and how he was, it was the Silk Roads book, and he was going into his collection of globes, maps, and things like that. I mean, was it sort of an interest in maps, or how did you get interested in geography? Because I think it's fair to say most Americans are not that interested in geography.
Yeah, I mean, my family had a big National Geographic World Atlas, and a very old Rand McNally one as well, in addition to that. And, you know, that was like a special possession back then. You know, if I'm thinking back, I mean, my earliest memories are like the late 1980s, But this was before we had the internet, and an atlas was this wonderful luxury item, and it was so enthralling to me to go from page to page and see these massive maps of whole countries and just think that there are just millions of people living in these places, all kind of shrunken down in encapsulated in this one miniaturized image. And it just kind of it always blew my mind to think that when you just look at a map of India, it's like there are millions and millions and millions of people living their lives, day to day, year to year, all squeezed in to this one image. And I just spent a lot of time just looking at maps. And then once the internet did come along, that created different possibilities, being able to look at maps with layers and rotate them and look at them, look at maps from different times, and see how these places have changed. So it kind of just exploded from there. But for me, that wasn't until I was a teenager that became possible. And yeah, it's just history. I mean, I love literature, and I've always said history, all it is, the word just means story. It's just stories. It's just talking about people and understanding what they did and why and what they experienced. So to me, it was free entertainment. There was nothing. People complain about remembering dates, and I think it is important to know dates, like those are signposts and they matter, but it's just free entertainment. I never found anything burdensome about it at all, in contrast to science, which I could like pull off, and I can understand the concepts, but God, chemistry is the thing that nearly killed me. So to me, it's like my whole life, my whole career, it's been tremendous fun.
That's amazing. Yeah, and I've thought about this because I'm probably about the same age as you, and I remember this scarcity of information very vividly. If you wanted to find something out, you needed to go to a library, basically. And
Yeah.
so we may be on this particular sort of cusp where we're old enough to remember the scarcity, but young enough to kind of be I don't know, able to use the new resources. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I mean, it is funny. We're in a really transitional generation. And I've often thought in recent years, I thought that when I'm really old, we're going to be among the last people in the world who remember life before the internet. We're basically a few years younger than us, and you're too young to remember it. So we'll be among the last who can even talk about life before the internet in our world. But yeah, I think we've become accustomed to the world of being always plugged in to the internet. And there actually was a point about, I guess it was about 7 or 8 years ago, I went with a group of friends to our friend's house in Vermont, where there was no internet and no cell phone reception. And that was kind of a departure for us at that point. And there was one point where we had a disagreement about daylight savings time and where it applied, where it was practiced and where it was not. And we had no way to resolve it except there in this vintage 1950s house in Vermont, there was a World Book Encyclopedia on the shelf. And we said, all right, well, I guess we have to pull out this book of the encyclopedia and look it up. And we found the answer and said, wow, we just used an actual encyclopedia on paper to find a piece of information. And that was, I think that probably was the last time that I was actually outside of the internet, outside of cyberspace for more than a day. And we survived, and I resolved I would not look at my email, and I didn't the whole time. I said, I'm just not even going to try, not even going to look. But, you know, it's hard at this point, it's hard to even function that way. But, you know, we don't have to get too deeply into that. Everyone knows about that, you know, about the emails that pile up and the missed calls and so forth.
And so you said by the end of high school, you were quite interested in history, and I guess you majored in that. And was that kind of your goal all along to, you know, enter academia or to do lectures in the end or to teach?
Yes. I mean, that was the obvious path, you know, and I was perfectly happy to go down that path. I mean, there are other things. I mean, I love writing. I've written some fiction and poetry, and, you know, I've thought about working on other things, but it always seemed like being a historian and history professor was the obvious path before me. And there actually, I had a longtime babysitter who helped to raise me and my brother, who used to refer to me when I was like 11, 12 years old. She'd refer to me as the professor. And you know,
that's hilarious.
That was how we understood things. And, you know, and I have sort of dipped my toe into that, but, you know, I've had the title. I've taught a few college classes and had the title of professor. But, you know, I was never exactly dead set on it at the same time. It was like the obvious thing to do, but it wasn't like I was passionate about the idea of having students or being on a tenure committee or, you know, or having a tweed jacket with elbow pads in an office with a, you know, a brandy snifter and so forth. So, so to me, once I saw how dysfunctional the whole system was and the kind of, you know, the sacrifices that it involved that I just didn't like, it was not that hard for me to say, well, I guess I'm going to figure out something else. You know, and I think probably all of us have heard, I've talked about this some at some point on the podcast, and how, you know, it's super, super competitive, which is, you know, not unique to the academic industry, but it's, you know, am I allowed to swear? You're the host. Can I swear?
Yeah, you can swear.
You know, there's so much ass kissing, and it's such a, you know, when I was in grad school, I sometimes made jokes about it, how the, you know, you read books like, you know, Gordon Wood's Radicalism of the American Revolution, and he talks about how society, pre-revolutionary society, was all about deference and vertical patronage and courtiers, and I would say this is grad school. It's all vertical patronage. It's all kissing the butt of the next person who you think might, you know, get you a leg up. And I was just like, I'm not that person. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I could understand that. So you liked the lecturing aspect, though, but you didn't like the sort of admin or, and you weren't super attached to, you know, having students or things like that. Is that fair to say, or?
Yeah, I mean, academia, it's like a lot of, you know, a lot of professors do love teaching, and a lot of professors do it well. I mean, to be fair, but the more common attitude is to treat that as kind of the chore that you do on the side, while your real work is publication, conferences, you know, reviews, commenting on other people's work, editing magazines and publications, you know, that's more often seen as sort of the real serious work that makes you a real scholar. And the teaching is just sort of the dirty work. And, you know, and the understanding is that as you become more senior, you will teach less. And that is what most people do. There are notable exceptions. I was always kind of flabbergasted when I was at Columbia at how Eric Foner would keep showing up to these, you know, dinky little meetings about someone's prospectus. And I would say, Eric Foner, what are you doing here? Don't you have better things to do? But he was, that was what made him exceptional. You know, the more common attitude was, I am so noted, I'm so accomplished, I don't even have to show up. And I could name names, but I don't know if anyone cares. They're not even that famous. But it's it just seemed upside down to me. And when it comes to teaching, a lot of teaching is very hard, and it's a very sophisticated skill, especially by the standards of today, when just going in and lecturing is not considered good pedagogy. But the thing is, if the class is big enough and there, yes, are and there are different personalities in there, then you can go in there and lecture most of the time and have it be very interesting and have the students really like it. And you will get feedback and interaction at different moments, sometimes in unpredictable ways. So to me, having a large lecture class was great. It was like, okay, I was like, this is fabulous. I'll go in there and just tell the story. You know what I mean? Like, don't, you don't have to be so didactic about it. Just tell the story as best you can, like a human being, and people will understand. People will see that you enjoy it, and they'll see that you love it, and that will come across. Small seminars are different, I think, and they're much harder.
Okay,
you don't have the same material to work with. So you know, basically the logic all kind of flows that once I said, all right, well, I can just record lectures and put them on SoundCloud and see what people think. I have an unlimited audience, and all kinds of interesting ideas and responses come back. You know, there's an endless wealth of exchange, which is only increased, you know, as the audience has increased. But I love it. I love seeing people commenting, and it's part of why, you know, I listen to various other podcasts, only a few history ones, more on political or on art and literature. And I always comment. This is my message to everyone. If you like it, press like or comment, I liked it, because so few people do that. It's such a tiny fraction. It's one in a thousand who even bothers, and it can make a tremendous difference. And I find it so amazing sometimes when people will talk about podcasts they love and they'll be so enthusiastic about it, and then they never make a comment. They never email. And I'm like, do it. If you love it, tell the podcaster. It can make their week.
It could affect their decision on whether to continue it, right?
Yeah, those things make a difference. Those things make a difference, especially, I think, if they're in, you know, earlier stages, they haven't built up such a big audience yet. It can be a tremendous gauge of whether what they're doing is reaching people, you know. Absolutely. And just the play count is not enough. So that's my message to everyone.
That's a great message, and I totally know exactly how that feels, because I, you know, the kind of deafening silence after you post a podcast or something can be overwhelming, because, you know, we're old enough to remember what it was like to give a lecture in person, and then, you know, people respond to that. You know, like, if you give an impassioned lecture, there's some kind of reaction in the room, right?
Yeah, you see the frowning faces and the stroking chins. You know, it's this immediate visual response. But if you take the 2 seconds to say something back after you loved a podcast, it makes a huge difference. And that's part of why, I mean, I see Colin Gorey in here. I have some people who have been who swooped in like immediately. When I had posted like 4 or 5 things and immediately started, you know, commenting or tweeting about it. And that, you know, that was a real indicator. It was like, okay, someone sees what I'm doing here. This will get through to somebody. And then, you know, from there, you just have to have faith that there are more people like that out there, and it's going to kind of percolate week by week, month by month.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will invite people up in a little while so if Colin wants to speak, we can hear about how he found you and things like that. Because I'm always curious about, you know, about that. How do you find someone who's only, you know, just starting out? I also wanted to ask you about storytelling, because you do an amazing job in your podcast of telling a story at both a very high kind of societal level and at an individual level. But you also have a kind of way of questioning the dominant story. And I just wondered, is that kind of common to most historians? Is that, are you in particular kind of skeptical about narrative?
Skepticism as relating to storytelling.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think that the sort of skepticism you're talking about is somewhat common among historians, but definitely not universal. And I think that there's a sort of constant dialectic between trying to build up and extrapolate grand narratives and trying to break them down and undermine them with specifics and with complications. And so historians are always kind of in this back and forth conversation. And I think that some historians are more on one side than the other. Some historians know what their theoretical framework is for history, and they know what they are trying to say about modernity and all of these, grand narratives, basically. And there are others who, are gadflies and pick away at those and sometimes try to reorient the story. And the two can sometimes get very irritated with one another. some people, it's sort of like similar to an interaction I had on Twitter a little while ago where someone posted a video and I said, "Is this staged? I'm really skeptical that this is real." And someone replied, "Oh, you're that Twitter skeptic guy." and that's often a lot of people's reaction is like, "Oh, come on, like, you're too difficult an audience. You just go along with the story. Stop being an annoying nitpicker." So that's a frequent problem that comes up both ways in history. But I guess where I'm a little unusual is just that I do try to take apart big grand narratives. I'm not against them across the board. I'm not saying that you can never extrapolate a larger, broader story. And I think that I do that in, a lot of my stuff, and I'm talking about the Middle Ages and the Reformation. I'm not against that on principle. I just think that you have to use an ordinary level of skepticism and stop and say, wait, do we really have evidence that shows that this is how it happened? You have to be careful and resistant before you, I think, subscribe to these big stories about whatever it is, modernity, capitalism. And what often happens with me is that I'll take something like capitalism and initially I'll be sort of skeptical but ambivalent about it and say, maybe it captures something, but let me comb through the details. Where did this concept come from? Where did the term come from? And then by the time I'm done, I'm completely against it. By the time I'm finished, I'm like, I really gave this one the benefit of the doubt, but it's clearly no good. But and what's unusual is that people sometimes think then, or they speak sort of, at least in some cases, they speak as if, well, then I'm a deconstructionist or I'm a postmodernist. And I'm like, look, deconstruction is fine. Like, people can do it or not. It's great. I've read a little bit of Derrida, not very much. I've read some Foucault. I'm not as well read as some people are. But it's like, you don't have to be immersed in this critical theory. Yes. In order to just have a normal degree of skepticism. Yes. Just stop and ask, wait, do we really know this story is true? And I feel like at root, that's all I'm doing here. Like, I'm not trying to make some grand theoretical point. I'm just saying this story doesn't seem to be true to me. And I guess that's just where I'm a bit unusual, that I'm just not socialized into some ideological camp. I'm not on this side of the department or that side of the department, although I have my leanings and I have my political views, which and those affect how I look at these stories the same as they influence anybody. But yes. I really try to be careful and impartial and not just tell the story that I want that will serve my kind of political predilections. I really resist that. And there are some radical historians who say don't resist it. There's some radical historians who say history is always political. You're always putting forward a political argument. There's no objectivity, et cetera, et cetera. But I still have maybe this sort of naive skepticism and resistance of saying, no, I want to know that I have put forward a well-supported, well-evidenced argument, and I am not just grasping at whatever fits my biases.
Yes. Yeah, that's really useful. I mean, it's something that I've thought about, not just deconstruction, but it's kind of just like a curiosity about origins. I've been reading Nietzsche, and you know, he's got this idea that you kind of can't understand the factors that led to something when in its finished product. It's like almost the worst place to kind of look. And when I listen to your podcast, I can kind of sometimes hear some of that, which is that, you know, you do look at, okay, when do we first start talking about, you know, a period called the Middle Ages or a thing called Judaism or a thing, you know, like a, and so, yeah, I just wondered if you had, is it partly that kind of desire to go back into sources that drive, like a curiosity that drives it?
Are you still there? I just,
I am still here. Yeah.
Okay, great. I think, there's an undeniable thrill to reading Nietzsche, whether you are convinced to share his worldview or not. And he was a philologist, you know, he was a Victorian philologist who, in a lot of instances, just made very simple and cutting arguments about the basic incoherence of concepts and terms, and basically that you can't really define things like justice or punishment except by looking at how they have been used socially as tools of social power and social relationships. And it's kind of impossible to look at what he did and understand the power of it and not be influenced and not be to some degree influenced to try to do the same thing. And that's why there's kind of no going back, right, to pre-Nietzsche. And I, you know, I suppose that kind of over time I have gravitated more towards that point of view. Not that I agree with his kind of ethical conclusions. I don't know, maybe Absolutely. That's a cop-out. I'm sure many Nietzscheans would say that's a cop-out. but to, you know, to basically drop the whole project of analytical philosophy, no offense to any British analytical philosophers that might be listening, but there's something very liberating to realizing I don't have to tell you what religion is. I don't have to tell you what democracy is. I just have to be aware that this is a term and a set of associations that were pulled together in a certain place and time that serve a certain function. And, you know, make of that what you will. And I just had this discussion this afternoon with a patron who I guess was going back and listening to earlier stuff, and he started responding to my lecture about Judaism. What, you know, Judaism, what is it and where does it come from? Which has, you know, sparked tons of reaction for year after year, right? It's been like 4 years, I think, since I posted it. And, you know, there's tremendous resistance to dropping the idea that Judaism is a religion with a set of doctrines and beliefs that can be compared against those of Christianity or Islam. And I understand there are counterpoints and counterarguments that people can make that I respect, but I do not find them persuasive at all. Mm. And I absolutely maintain it is an anachronistic misunderstanding to describe Judaism before 1700 yes. as a religion or a system of beliefs or doctrines. And that is a projection of ideas from other places onto a place where they don't make any sense. And, you know, and to some degree, I'm sort of talking Wittgenstein here too, right? That the concepts and terms have traction in certain realms, and then you move them somewhere else and they have no traction. And you end up just kind of sliding around with nothing to grab onto, you know. And his metaphor was like taking ice skates and trying to walk on gravel, or taking cleats and trying to walk on ice. And it's just the wrong question to try to ask, what did Jews in the pre-modern world believe, right? Mm. What are the core beliefs of Judaism? And you know, and I respect that people see it differently, and there are people who know some about the Torah and the Talmud who don't agree with what I'm saying, but I'm always running up against this barrier of like, why do you insist on seeing it this way? Why, what if you just took those goggles off and looked at it the other way that I'm saying? And it's like the snow will slide off your roof, right? That's the saying. It's like, oh, I don't have to care about this anymore. And it's like all these ancient texts that you're looking at, trying to turn them into something they're not, trying to turn the Torah into the New Testament and so forth. It's like once you stop doing that, it all just makes more sense. It's like you're unburdened. And so I think that's a lot of why people have kind of wrestled with a lot of things that I'm saying, is that I'm just trying to say, you know, I'm not a deconstructionist. I have nothing against deconstructionists. I'm not a disciple of Derrida. I'm just saying you've got things wrong historically. I'm just saying your narrative is mistaken and you have to look at it from a different angle. And I guess, I don't know, I guess that's just the niche I happen to fill.
And could you characterize that kind of opposition, or like, so is the opposite position, has it caused controversy because people want to say Judaism is this kind of coherent religion before that period, or?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, it's like hilarious when I look at some comments, and I shouldn't be mean. Although some, you know, YouTube is where you get the most reaction. For whatever reason, YouTube elicits more response and commentary than any other platform. And, you know, and you get all sorts of people. You get very erudite, very, you know, judicious people commenting. You get Looney Tunes. And of course, anything about Jews, you get lots of anti-Semitic Looney Tunes commenting. But I have gotten, you know, a lot of comments saying, how could you say Judaism isn't a religion? They have a God, they have a holy book, they had a temple, etc., etc. How could that possibly not be a religion? And I'm like, yeah, but look at what you're doing. You're taking these features of this social system and you're comparing them against Christianity and saying, look at these points of commonality, therefore it's religion. Why do you need to do that? You know, and the thing is, there are reasons why people do that. It's, and they're social and political reasons. You know, it's wanting legitimacy, it's wanting legal status and protection. You know, in America, religious practice is protected. So if you can say where you're, you know, and I'm not saying this to knock anyone, you know, and I'm Jewish and I practice Judaism in a very lax way, but you just have to see that you're a historical creature who has certain needs and interests and priorities in your own time and place. And so you use this conceptual scheme to label things. And yes. people are obsessed with labels. It's mm-hmm. amazing how people are obsessed with labels. And you have to apply this label. You have to, you know, a bank is capitalist. A workers' co-op is not capitalist. I'm like, who cares? Put whatever adjective on it you want. It doesn't, there's no there, right? It's all politics. And I guess that goes back, you know, to the basic point from Nietzsche, right? That applying words and concepts to things around you in your world is a kind of basic political act. It's how you make sense of the world and order the world and create and recreate a social system.
Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, it was in that Judaism episode, which is fantastic, by the way, where you talk about this kind of almost invention of this concept of religion, where, you know, Europeans start going to other parts of the world and saying, what's your religion? And this is almost universally misunderstood. Is that from that episode, or is that right?
Yes. I think I touched a bit on the invention of world religions. And, you know, this was something that came out of European colonialism and the encounter of Europeans with the rest of the world was that they sort of came armed with this category and concept of religion. And they basically went around to other places in the world. And, you know, as I like to think of it, they asked, are you a good witch or a bad witch? You know, they had this binary of religion and secular, and they had to somehow go around and separate out, you know, sort these people and phenomena around the world into religion versus non-religion, religion versus secular. And it just wasn't, that was just not a scheme of categorization that other people in the world knew. I mean, they might have something kind of similar, but not the same thing. And, you know, and this is a thing, I will take a little credit, that this is a thing when I was just starting grad school, where I was talking with friends and acquaintances who were in religious studies. And yes. I started asking, like, what is religious studies? How do you decide what's religious and what's not? You know, there's art and music and family and marriage. And how do you sort out, like, this is a religious thing and this isn't? You know, and I sort of already, just from knowing a little bit of medieval history, I already was like, something doesn't seem right here. And the reaction that I got from some of them was, yeah, that's really a central dilemma in religious studies. We don't really have any agreement on exactly what we mean when we say this is religious or it isn't. You know, and then looking into it, I found, okay, this is basically an artifact of debates and evolution within Christianity, right? That people had to sort of sort out what they considered to be religion in order to then be able to say, these are the things that we have to tolerate about one another. These are the things that we have to stop fighting about and accept that they're unresolvable. Right. But then things that sort of relate to civil law or family law, like marriage, didn't generally fall into that basket. And so they sort of have a separate life unto themselves, outside religion, in quotation marks.
On the one hand, it's very funny that the idea that you come into a bunch of experts in religious studies and you say, what do you mean by religion? And there's just a big shrug. But I suppose, you know, you come into a room of physicists and you say, what is matter? And you might get a similar, like, you end up in this kind of metaphysical realm where, like, it's like, I don't know, somehow out of scope.
I think that's exactly right. I think every discipline has certain kind of, you know, it's like in geometry, the undefined terms of geometry, point, line, and plane. It's like every discipline has some kind of organizing guideposts that they just have to accept, even though they know that they can't really define them. right? Mm, but but if you're really worried about that, you go to the philosophy department, right?
Yeah, and they say, sorry, we're analytic philosophers. We don't deal with anything like that. I would love to ask you about some of your research. So if you know, you're working on this Florida series. I think you're about to start on the history of China, which seems like a big task. And then I think, were you doing Neo-Assyria after Banipal? And I'm trying to think what else. You've got the 100 objects as well. Like, how do you structure all this in your head? And while I do that, I'm going to invite people up in case they want to ask questions. Is that all
okay,
right?
Okay, okay. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the scheme that I have in my head, which I guess I've never exactly explicitly explained, is that I alternate between sort of ordinary episodes, which are, you know, a lecture, an hour or more lecture on some, you know, broad, significant topic, and then episodes that are part of an ongoing series. So the way I think of it is like, all right, each month I want to at least produce at least one ordinary lecture, which might be on a medieval topic, an American topic, and then at least one that is part of one of the ongoing series. And there are three ongoing series: the 100 objects, the archaeological discoveries, and myths of the month. And part of why I started doing the archaeological discoveries was because I found that the timing worked out better if I had three ongoing series instead of two. So then with each of those series, I could switch back and forth between a public episode accessible to everyone and a patron-only episode on Patreon. So if I'm doing three of them, it works out so that it alternates, right? And that keeps it kind of balanced from month to month, roughly speaking. So that's the way I'm going about it. So I don't know if that actually clarified things, but well, it's yeah, like...
That does make sense. So yeah, you've got different series going on at once, and then you've got the kind of broader, like subjects. But I guess I was also asking, how do you manage all of that in your head? You're going from history of China, you're going history of Florida, you've got the myth of the month, you've got the Library of Ashurbanipal. Is it just kind of, you just put everything in there, then see what comes out, or...
Yeah, I'm really all over the map. I mean, I like to have sort of two or three topics picked out in advance, so I sort of know what I'm doing for the next month or two. If I have options, I put up Twitter polls, which I'm probably all or most of you have seen. I'll put up a poll of like, what should be the next myth of the month? And often I'll follow that. Sometimes I'll just pick something anyway. But you know, like with Florida, Florida didn't win a poll, but I knew that it was with Florida, that it was this huge, just beautiful, juicy subject that people didn't realize was there. You know, that was kind of the idea of it, is that people don't think Florida has any history. So I just knew, like, I'm going to sit down and do this one regardless. But a lot of others I go by the poll. And with the Library of Ashurbanipal, that was the one that won that poll of what should be the next archaeological discovery topic. I think it beat out Machu Picchu, which kind of surprised me a little. I am all over the map, it's true, but I think of them thematically. You know, I don't think of it as like, oh, now I'm leaping over to China and that's going to sort of completely take me out of context. I mean, I need to research and learn more. And I've got several books about early, you know, pre-Qin or pre-Han China that I'm going to read and, make my notes and make my outline from. But to me, it's like, well, you know, I did this one on India and I sort of went in with similar questions, wanting to get a feel of how does the natural environment support population? How did people live and survive? And then how did they make, you know, how did they make art and cities and literature? And so to me, it's like they're all kind of in parallel, right? It's, I don't see them as so disparate, because I'm going in with a certain kind of sense of what I want to understand and what the product is going to look like. And you know, and I came from geography, right? Like I've always wanted to know about all parts of the world, you know, and in history, you do have to specialize. It's very unusual for anyone to really jump around or to be a generalist, you know, and people are sort of cooking up different geographic formulations of, well, we work on the Indian Ocean basin or the Atlantic world, but still people are specialized. But part of what's liberating about doing your own podcast is you can just decide to learn about whatever you want and put it out there. And some expert in the field might say, might have a response, might say X or Y. But I think my record is pretty good. You know, like I have had Latin Americanists, you know, I have a friend who's a Latin Americanist who assigned her students to listen to my lecture about the conquest of the Americas. Wow. And, you know, like, I really want to have my facts straight, and I really want to present them well. And I think it holds up. I really think it holds up, you know, and I've ventured into Central Asia and the Roma and gotten huge response because, I mean, there aren't that many experts who will really even be able to tell you about those fields. But there have only been a few instances where someone really took issue. I mean, on my Martin Luther one, which was somewhat a little bit justified, I don't totally agree with their criticisms, but there have only been a couple of points where someone very knowledgeable in the field has said, you got this or that wrong.
Mm-mm. And what do you do when that happens, actually? So,
well, it depends on the case. I mean, sometimes I say thank you, and I might add a little correctional note. Sometimes I say if I disagree, you know, it depends. Mm-hmm. It depends on the case, you know, and sometimes people kind of come at you with like a barrage, you know, and this happened like with the Martin Luther one. Someone came out with like a barrage of points he took issue with. And I was like, all right, I see a couple of small points here where I recognize that I was wrong on this point, that there were some translations of parts of the Bible, just not the entire Bible. But then surrounding that was all this theology. You know, this guy was a total dyed-in-the-wool, fanatical Catholic, trad-cath, hates Martin Luther, hates Protestantism, and just was like taking issue with Martin Luther's theology. And I'm like, look, I don't care. I'm not a theologian. I'm telling you what happened historically. So that was one where I just didn't respond. I was like, I don't need to get into the weeds about this. I recognize they have a couple valid points of criticism, but I'm not going to get into some back and forth with someone who's very ideologically motivated. And then there are other points where, like with my India one, I said that the Mahabharata came first before the Ramayana. And you know, there are some, I think, who have argued that, and it depends a lot on, well, you know, which manuscript is older, how old do you think the text is that was recorded in this manuscript? So there's some gray area, but it is generally believed that the Ramayana was composed earlier. So this listener pointed this out, and I said, thank you, that's a good correction, and that makes sense. But that was like it, and they said, other than that, this was great. Yes. And I was like, good, fabulous.
That's amazing. Yeah, I think we've got some people up on the stage. So Nathaniel, I think you were first. Would you like to ask anything or say anything?
Yeah, I would. Long time listener to the podcast, really big fan. I think you do a great job. I had a question because I have a bit of a history background. That was my undergrad in university, but then afterwards I sort of went more into public policy. And if you get into public policy, you're just going to encounter lots of people who with very like social science backgrounds who live their entire lives inside one methodological framework and like just can't comprehend that there might be other ones or that their framework might be limited. I thought particularly that it was my history background that made me realize some of the limitations of that. I mean, particularly talking to people who are they just can't. They don't understand the role that like culture and institutions play in shaping how people think. And I was just wondering how, because the two disciplines I've noticed that push back against sort of that like choice models are history and anthropology. And I think that might just be because people in that discipline are trained to sort of jump between frameworks more. And that makes them more skeptical of some of the formal rational. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts. There are many different ways, I guess, to respond to that. I mean, one of the things I like about history is that it's conceptually and methodologically open-ended. You know, you can really attack it all kinds of ways. And it isn't, I think, as predicated upon a certain, you know, interpretive scheme as social sciences usually are. There are sort of deeply embedded, I think, assumptions about human behavior that you kind of have to subscribe to if you are to be legitimate in sociology, psychology, anthropology. Maybe I'm being unfair, but that is certainly my understanding. In history, it's really a free-for-all. And, you know, I am lucky that I can kind of mix and match and, you know, take anthropological arguments and ideas and use them when I think they're illuminating, as well as sociological, you know, and like, and I have a lot of appreciation for a lot of anthropology, even though I don't think I could ever be an anthropologist. I don't think I could make that kind of ideological leap. So, but to make it an even bigger, you know, to make a hot take, if you want a hot take, I was saying to my friend Michael a few months ago that in my...
Sam, you're cutting in and out. We lost you for about 30 seconds.
Oh, you did?
There.
Did you miss my hot take?
I think we missed your hot take.
You literally said, here's a hot take, and then you...
Oh, no. Someone said it's too dangerous. It's too hot. But
Twitter cut you out.
but I mean, if it was up to me, I would say that all social sciences, anthropology, psychology, sociology, I say they are all subfields of history. The history is the attempt to account for human behavior in context. And if you're not taking specific contexts into account, then you have these blinders and you're going to have, you know, inadequate arguments. And that basically everything, all fields of knowledge, in my opinion, fall into just two actual overarching fields, which are physics and history. Either you're doing physics, you're trying to extrapolate the regular constant laws that govern the universe, or you're trying to account for human behavior in context. That's it. So I would say that those should be the two like big mega departments. There's physics and there's history, and you know, chemistry and and astrophysics. Those are all subfields of physics. And in my opinion, anthropology, sociology, psychology, art history, those are all subfields of history. So that's how I, you know, kind of organize my scheme of knowledge. And so I don't see those other fields as opposed to history. I think that if they have no historical awareness, if they are ahistorical, then they're inadequate, right? And their arguments are going to be weaker. So when I read a book of anthropology, I read it as history, and I say, is this person's argument persuasive or not? And are they being ahistorical? And does that matter? But I think a lot of it is great, and I use a lot of it.
That's great. Yeah, it is a fascinating one, because I guess there's two, and this is a kind of philosophy of history and kind of question. I know archaeology deals with it, which is like, you know, what kind of proof works if you can't run experiments, right? There's a kind of divide between experimental sciences and historical sciences. I'm only like vaguely aware of the debate, but it's two types of justification, I guess, right?
Yes, I think that you're dealing with two very different levels and dimensions of experience. And the fact is, proof history cannot produce the kinds of proofs that one wants to see in hard sciences, or what I would just call physics, right? It's not, and it's that's not possible. You cannot prove anything that definitely, because you the fundamental assumptions are different. You know, it's mistaken, I think, to think that human behavior is as predictable and controllable as physical phenomena are in a controlled environment, right? Mm-hmm. You can't, you can't produce a controlled experiment for history. It doesn't happen. So the arguments are different, you know, and this was a debate in history as well, which I think is more or less settled now, that the question of whether history can be objective, I think you would be very hard pressed to find any contemporary historians who would say they're capable of doing objective history that would meet the kind of standards of physics or chemistry or even biology. It's just not that kind of discipline, and it's not that kind of subject matter.
Isabella, would you like to weigh in on psychology or ask anything else?
I am so tempted to get into this because I am or was sort of a psychology professor. Well, I wasn't sort of, I was a psychology professor. And it's just, it's so tempting because I kind of mostly agree with you, but the devil's in the details, but I won't. I will go into another question. First of all, thank you for this conversation, the both of you. I'm really, really enjoying all aspects of it. And given that the title was The Life of a History Podcaster, I will try to stay as pragmatic and maybe pedestrian as I can, because I'm deeply interested in your process of actually researching and producing, not, I don't mean what equipment do you use, but producing your podcast, because as I hear you talking, you seem to be annoyingly as articulate and coherent as you are on your podcast, and seem to be able to keep, you know, the meta frame from which you start all the way through your argument and so on. And so I'm hoping that that's not actually just totally natural, and that you don't wing it entirely when you press record. But I'm really interested in what your research process is, to the point that you then spit it out into an oral form on the recording itself. Do you get into books and do you write notes on paper, then digitize it? Is it all digital? Is it all, you know, do you have any kind of outline? Do you write a word for word? I'm very interested in that process.
Yeah, I do outline, usually in a lot of detail. I found that it tends to be about a page per 10 minutes of material, roughly speaking. So if it's like a hour and 40 minute lecture, it'll be about 10 pages of outline. Mm-hmm. That's normal. So when I decide on a topic, it varies a lot depending on how widely available the information is and how much I'm already familiar with it. So it's going to be different working, say, on China as compared to if I'm doing an early American subject, because I need to have more of my details on paper that I can't just pull up from my head. So when I decide to do a topic, usually the first thing, as I say, is there some book that is going to really make my life easier, and can I get it? And so that's the first thing I search for, because it takes the longest to obtain them. So I have a very, very good public library that's part of a network in central and western Massachusetts. And I will basically, I'll look and search online and try to find, is there like a landmark book that people have used as a primer on this subject? Is there a good biography? I'll try to get that through my library. And about 2/3 of the things I want usually are there. It's really a really good system. And if not, then I try to buy it. And, you know, thrift books, Abe books, I try to get as cheap as I can. And then once I've sort of ascertained, is there a book or two that will really help me or not? Then I go into JSTOR, I look for articles. You know, I've lived a lot of my life on JSTOR, And I look for anything, you know, popular magazine articles, historical journals, you know, maybe I look at WMQ or 18th century, depending on what the subject is. And then I basically just read, usually for 2 or 3 days is normal. Sometimes with some topics, it's even been longer. I mean, obviously, like with the Holy Grail, I guess I produced about 5 hours of material. So mm-hmm. It was at least a week of just reading. And usually I will just read. And I will make no notes or very little, like minimal. Just when I know that I've just found a fact that's critical, I might make a note of it, you know, a name, a quote. But I don't make much notes at all, because initially when reading, I don't know what's significant enough that I'm going to want to remember it. So after a couple of days of reading, then I start making my outline. I put everything aside and I start saying, all right, what is the basic form of this lecture? What are the, you know, is it by periods? Is it by person? Is it by concept? And I make my headings. I start filling in points. And this is where, like, I start going a little crazy, where I'll sort of run to my computer and think, oh God, I've got to remember to put this point under that one and add in a note. And then I say, okay, what are the missing things? And I'll make some sort of mark usually in my outline. I'll make like an ampersand often and say, that's a mark to show that there's a point or a fact that I need that I have to draw from this book or this article. And I'll know to go back and look for that. And I'll find my names, my dates, my quotations, the sequence of events in a story, and fill that in. And usually if it's a topic that I don't already know very well, it is usually about a page per 10 minutes. And I, you know, it's an outline, it's all these indentations, all these marks, arrows, bolds. And then I print it on paper. And I sit down with my mic and I start going through it, and I explain each point, you know, the same as I would in a lecture room. And occasionally I mess up. There are vocalized pauses. There are coughs. And sometimes there are long pauses where I'm like, uh-oh, I lost my place in my outline. where am I? Did I skip something? You know, and so then I just go silent and say nothing for 30 seconds, a minute, until I've got my place again and I'm ready again. And then I resume. And if it's a nice long pause like that, then when I'm finished, I look at the file in Audacity and I can see where the mess ups are. They're visible. And I go through and I find, the points where I corrected myself or where I had a long pause, and edit them out. And usually that will take about twice as long as the length of the lecture. So like if it's an hour and a half lecture, it might take about 3 hours or sometimes a bit less. If it was not too rocky, it'll take a little less than twice that long to go through and edit it. And usually I can do that and post it the same night. Because, you know, once I've done that much and there's that much adrenaline, I really want to get it finished and get it posted. So the whole recording, editing, posting might take like 5-6 hours in total.
Amazing. I love this kind of nitty gritty information. Thank you for sharing that. And did it change over the course of all of these? I thought I'll stop now. I just wanted to make sure that, is this your end process, that it's now the one day experience of recording and pitching it, or did you get to that after many, many tries?
It evolved, because I've just become a bit more meticulous about having more detailed notes, making sure I get all the good points that I want. And also I'm a little more meticulous about editing, you know, and I found that early on I edited almost not at all. Like I would leave in practically anything, you know, and I have all these ums and heavy breathing. And I just put it out there, and listeners are very forgiving. You know, listeners will put up with practically anything, but I just became a little more perfectionist about it. I wanted it to sound a little better and to move a little faster. I didn't like the slowdown of those extra pauses. So I edit more than I used to, and I feel like it's at a pretty good medium. I'm not as meticulous about it as some are. And sometimes I don't like it when it goes to the opposite extreme and people really edit heavily and it sounds like it's going too fast, kind of unnaturally fast. So yeah, it's basically over the past couple of years that I've kind of settled into this medium point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colin, would you like to ask a question?
Yes. Well, first of all, I would just like to thank Sam for all the work over the years. It's been quite a while since I've started listening. I think I've been since the very initial Middle Ages series.
You were an early adopter for sure. Yeah. And thank you for being a supporter and a booster this whole time.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Well, Isabel asked my original question, so I've got to come up with a new one on the fly. What, Sam, do you think is the prospect for this kind of model of education, where we're able to go into more of a more specialized material than you'll see in the sort of 101 stuff you find on YouTube, where they're really chasing the big audiences? Do you think that this kind of model has legs and could apply for apply to more fields than history? Even if they are just all branches of history, I learned that I'm a historian.
I know, you didn't realize you're a historian. Well, linguistics is very historically conscious, which I appreciate. But that's a really hard question for me. I'm actually, ironically, quite low tech. You know, all of these things have been new excursions for me as I learn them. But what there is there's a tremendous demand to learn. It's amazing the curiosity that's out there among the public. And that was one thing that was kind of seamless for me, was that when I gave lectures in the classroom, I would see people intrigued and surprised and responding and thinking about things differently. And that does come across online, and I think there's certainly a huge demand for, like, give me a crash course in philosophy 101, and people like that. I watch Yale lectures posted on YouTube. There's been great stuff about early modern Britain, and I've learned a lot. But there's also curiosity for, you know, what Jean Ray would call the forbidden truth knowledge, you know, of like, all right, please tell me what Wittgenstein said, please tell me what Foucault said. And, you know, sometimes I think people certainly want simpler answers than what they're getting, but the demand really is there. And I think that, I guess part of the open question, and maybe what you're thinking of, is like, okay, we know that there are channels like Lang Focus, and we know that there are, you know, Veritasium, you know, these producers who sort of address really big, wide subject areas in a kind of fun, visual way. What about more rigorous? You know, what about the people who really get into the weeds? What about the historians who talk about historiography? I think that I really don't know. And I can't say what the future holds. I know that it has worked out for me, but it worked out for me partly because I did many months of labor at very little pay, you know, on the hope that it would grow. And it has grown over time. It's still a tiny fraction of, say, Mike Duncan and Revolutions. You know, there's always an effect. And I keep thinking of this study, which it'll take too long to explain it all. But the fact that in any given field for public consumption, there's always going to be a small few who really rocket to the top and become stars. And then there are going to be a lot of others who get a bit of an audience, but much, much less. And it's unpredictable who that's going to be. And it's unpredictable, you know, who's going to be willing to do that slog, you know, of producing hours of material to get 100, 200 patrons, right? But all I can say is that the curiosity is out there and the audience is out there. And I don't have any easy explanation or any easy shortcut of how to get to them or whether that'll make it like viable, you know, as a model of education, like you were saying. I'm really not sure. It may take more creative minds to figure out exactly how to find the people and the niche and, you know, the producers and the audience and how to match them together. But the curiosity and the demand is there.
Thank you. Would Colin, would anyone like to ask any other questions, or I'm happy to ask some more as well. Feel free to unmute if you have anything you'd like. One thing I'd love to ask you, Sam, is about film, because you've done one on The Green Knight, and I seem to recall a pretty detailed take on It's a Wonderful Life, both of which were fantastic. And I imagine that's something that you get to do, you know, on a podcast without, which would be harder to get into a history lecture. could you tell me about your interest in film and how you think about its connection to history?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've always loved movies very much, and I've always thought that film is especially powerful medium. There's something, it's so enveloping, right? The moving images, the sound, the voices, the music. It is really like an immersing experience in a way that I think no other art form is on its own. I mean, maybe, you know, hearing a symphony in a cathedral is also enveloping, but you can convey many aspects of that in a movie, right? It can incorporate basically all other art forms, right? Other than maybe cuisine, you know, there are some things that you can't smell, right? Cuisine is a high art form as far as I'm concerned too. But film is such a complete and enveloping, powerful experience. And I think, again, you know, I'm in that generation that sort of who my brain was incubated in film and television just before then the internet came. And I guess for me, it was kind of formative, this. And, you know, I didn't go to church or synagogue. I mean, it's occasionally to synagogue on particular occasions, but film was sort of the closest thing to worship that we did when I was growing up. It was like you go into this dark room, everyone's quiet, and you see these beautiful things materialize in front of you. And I think a lot of people's deep kind of embedded understanding of the world, of like, you know, what is India like? What is Brazil like? What is space like? All comes through film, and it makes these deep impressions. And, you know, and of course, you know, we live in a world of fandom now, and people define their identities and their relationships by movies, and, you know, and evoke these whole worlds by a few notes from a movie score. And I guess it's something I haven't really tackled it as such, right? But I have brought it in at different points, you know, and even like I realized when I was doing my first one about the Middle Ages, I made this reference to All About Eve, you know, like it's always coming in, these movie scenes and lines and characters in all my lectures. But at the same time, I have to be very careful and skeptical about it, right? And a very common thing that scholars are asked, certainly historians and probably a lot of other scholars too, is they're asked, is this movie or TV show accurate, right? And I think I talked about this a little bit with my friend Sonia, who's a TV critic, who sort of asked, like, you know, what I think about film and history. And I said, you know, people often ask, is this accurate? Is this how it happened? And for one thing, the answer is always, to some degree, no. There, no one reproduces history exactly as it happened in a movie. It's not possible, and it would be super boring. So there, it's always right, like you'd be sitting there for weeks waiting for the Duke of Pavia's army to show up. And so it's always a dramatic production, and some things are always changed, and you know, it's not real, it's all artifice. And I guess I think part of what I said is, well, it's a perfectly worthwhile thing to ask, is this accurate? Did things unfold in this way? Did this person do X and Y? Was this person really assassinated? But the more important question that people don't really think to get to is, how is this movie trying to present us with a certain version of the world and a certain version of history? And what is the message? You know, what is the worldview that they are trying to get across in this work of drama on film? And that, I think, is more exciting and more rewarding. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I've mentioned, you know, I've also written articles of social commentary. And, you know, if you don't want to know what my politics are, don't look at them. But I'm constantly also taking films, plays, novels, and using them, you know, picking them up and using them. And it's not because I think that those things had any great effect on the course of history. You know, I don't think that Gilbert and Sullivan changed the course of history, but I think that they reveal something. They reveal the way people were working out and making sense of their world and making a mythology, right? You people are always kind of passing on, revising, and developing their mythologies. And so that's why I think they are significant, right? They're like little kind of windows into people's minds, into the mind of a society.
And so are they a part of your research to watch films? Just out of curiosity. Because I was thinking of, I think in both the Robin Hood series and in Arthurian legends, you kind of go through, these are the adaptations and things like that. And
You're right. I have watched movies as part of my research for Myths of the Month. And particularly, like you said, the King Arthur mythos and Robin Hood. I said, all right, what is the deal? Prince of Thieves, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, I probably saw it when I was like 12 and I had to rewatch it and figure out what the heck is going on. And so I did for that. And I did go back, I watched Percival de Galois for the Holy Grail series. And Excalibur I had seen many years ago. I think I rewatched it. That's part of what's so amazing about Arthur and Robin Hood is that they're still with us. We're still recreating them in different guises and different plot lines and different episodes today. There's always some King Arthur based TV show or play or musical or something being made all the time, like every day. And I finished watching Merlin, and it's like any one of these things, just like with the Green Knight, when I initially recorded my lecture on the Green Knight, it was about 3 hours and I edited it down to about 2.5, I think. And it's like,
amazing episode.
I'm glad you like it. That was one of my most disorganized because I couldn't print out the outline and I was kind of jumping around. It was probably the most improvised lecture done was on the Green Knight, but there was this nice story with an arc to it that gave it a little bit of structure. But like with Merlin, I watched this TV show Merlin. I could do 2 hours just analyzing how this British TV show in the early 2000s presented the Arthur mythology for that audience at that time. You could do you could do entire courses just on these things, and the material is endless. I mean, and I don't know, partly this is probably also a symptom of the fact that all mass entertainment today is retreads of something, right? Yes. There's so little originality, right?
But yes, but this is really fascinating. So you mainly do it for the myths of the month. So it's almost more like, it's almost like the myths of the month are kind of about the mythological landscape that we now inhabit that are kind of reflected in films. And so you might not, you know, if you're covering the, I don't know, early China, you might not go and watch a, you know, Chinese film about that or something. But if you were to do a myth one, you would. Is that?
I think that, I don't think I've ever done that. I think that maybe, you know, I'm not closed to it, but like, say, I'm sure there are great films about Qin, right? Mm. But maybe if I were, I would do my research in the historical scholarship first. I would look and see if there are interesting primary sources I can quote from. And then maybe afterwards, I would watch a film about it to sort of compare and reflect, like, okay, how are these movie makers presenting their picture of of these events, and what are they, you know, and how does it speak to modern China? But I wouldn't do it as part of my main research, you know. And I guess this is one of the ways in which I am not a postmodernist, in that I want to get the facts right. And and I do think that there is a difference between the best facts that you can access and the portrayal, right? Mm. I am conscious of that distinction. And I don't think that, you know, reality is collapsible to representation, right? Mm. Whereas if you look at some postmodern scholarship, which might be good, they collapse those things together. And it's funny that you mention that specifically, because I do love Jonathan Spence, who, and his book, The Death of Woman Wong, I think is a really great book. But it's a bit controversial. He is pretty postmodernist. And he has this like end section of Death of Woman Wong where he says, like, well, now I'm going to tell my story of how she died. That is a tissue of lines and images from different poems from that period. And I'm going to sort of weave them together into this little kind of almost like prose poem telling how she died. And I'm like, well, thanks, Jonathan Spence, but there's no evidence that that's what happened. This is just like your impressionistic rumination on what you imagine happened. And I'm sorry, that is not the same thing as the facts. And so to me, I'm like sorting out in my head, I'm like, all right, where is this launching off into his like imaginative flight, and where are the facts, right? And I don't know, if you ask Jonathan Spence, like, postmodernists are very squishy. Again, no offense, but they're very, very slippery about, like, oh, but it's all representation, and, you know, and this version of the story is just as valid as that one. And I'm like, no, don't buy it.
That's amazing. Zahi, would you like to ask a question?
You know what? When I got in this room, I didn't think I would. I actually got on the speaker thing. This is my first time on a space, so I have no clue what I just did. But
hi.
Yeah. This is how are you, Sam? Actually, is it Samuel, or do you go by Sam?
Usually Sam, but I'm not specific.
Okay. Cool. Well, Sam, I just want to thank you for all the podcasts and the great articles that you had. I really enjoy a lot of the work that you do, and I try to get other people to read them. One question I did have is, a while back, one podcast you did was something about Douglas Murray's History of Europe. And I loved it because you kind of just like, you completely like destroyed the argument there. But I was always kind of curious what your take is on like Edward Said's like Orientalism and the way like the West in general looks at the Orient or like at the Middle East in general. And how do you think that, like, especially with a lot of texts, do you think it has like some relevance? Because I know he was criticized a lot for it, but I wasn't sure historically, is it like something you take into account when you like look into your histories of like other places?
Yeah. Well, I think that Orientalism is a great book, and there certainly has been criticism, as there is of any great book. Nobody's perfect. I think that some people are very resistant to his kind of mode of analysis, but he makes very powerful arguments. And again, it's similar to what I said about Nietzsche. It's like, once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. Asia understood as the Orient, because geographically speaking, those are almost perfectly coterminous, you know, what we call Asia and what was called the Orient, that it's a place that existed in Europeans' imaginations. And there's a deep kind of, not just an atmosphere, but a kind of metaphysics to the way Europe understood the Orient. And it was ahistorical, you know, that there in this view, Europe is a place with history and the Orient is a place with culture. You know, I think I quoted my classmate Divya in some lecture. I quoted her saying, you know, why is it that Europe has history and the rest of the world has culture? And
yeah, I remember I actually particularly love that quote. I think it was when you were talking about the slave trade out of Asia or out of the Middle East or something. It was one of the podcasts you had a guest on, and I thought that was such an amazing quote.
Yeah, I think it really
does seem that way.
Yeah, it was the conversation with Jeff and about the dawn of everything, where, you know, arguably you could say they do a bit of the reverse. They sort of present Europe as unchanging and ahistorical. I would take issue with some claims that Edward Said makes in Orientalism. I know, and ironically, I think that some of those points I disagree with, that I think are mistaken, are points where he looks at Europeans as ahistorical, you know, and he makes claims about Jane Austen, that Jane Austen somehow supported the slave trade when in fact she was opposed to it. It's like, no, that's just incorrect. But he has these really powerful insights, I think. I remember him at one point saying, you can see how most Europeans really, who wrote about Asia, were really resistant to actually understanding the internal dynamics of the society. And they didn't want to understand the different classes, the different language and religious groups. They wanted to just see it all as sort of decadent, frozen in time, no dynamism, no evolution. And the exception was German scholars. And why would it be that Germans would have a much more nuanced and dynamic understanding of Asian societies than French and British scholars, who were just as prolific? Well, the Germans weren't colonizing Asia, right? They weren't trying to lay an ideological groundwork for why Europe, or their nation specifically, should govern Asia and bring them modernity, science, reason, etc., right? And that didn't necessarily hold true all the way into the 20th century, but in that sort of Victorian dawn of early anthropology, early linguistics, there's this marked difference. And, you know, and this is basically in line with the deconstructionist and postmodernist epistemology, which argues that knowledge is always a product of power, right? And that what you know about someone or something is conditioned by your power relationship with that person or thing. And it's a very eye-opening argument in an eye-opening book, and he's made a tremendous mark. And I think that the most strident critics of Edward Said were early on, and that argument has not carried the day. I think that most all historians, certainly historians who work on Asia and Africa, and who use some of those Victorian sources, right? Those early travel accounts, gazetteers, those early European descriptions of the Asian and African societies that they encountered, they all have this point in mind, right? That these are fundamentally Orientalist sources, and that they are predicated upon this European political project. I don't think anyone can discount that today. So that's just where I think it stands in historical scholarship.
Nice. Thank you so much for that. That's what I kind of thought. A lot of people tend to believe it. I know some people had criticized him because, like, you know, if Europeans looked at us better, it still wouldn't matter because we still live under despots today.
Kind of thing,
but like, I think a more materialist approach to that. But other than that, I think that was a great answer. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you. And thank you again for being a supporter and a listener. It's really great. And I think what you're saying is a very good point. And I think it just goes briefly. I think it goes to the problem of the limitations of this kind of postmodern symbolic and linguistic analysis, right? That you can't, I think many people have tried to kind of take that sort of social critique and commandeer it and draft it into a political struggle that really is more about material resources and force of arms, right? And like you're saying, you can't liberate Asia by critiquing French philologists, right? There are definitely these limitations to the political power or efficacy of that kind of social critique and literary critique. Fundamentally, he was a literary critic, right? And Orientalism is a work of literary analysis. So yeah, you're not going to liberate Southeast Asia through literary analysis, but nonetheless, it's had a really profound impact in scholarship.
Thank you for those questions. Isabella, would you like to ask anything else?
No, I think, there's too many questions that I have that would get way too specific on various pieces of the specific podcast. I do think it's really, one of the questions I also might have is just your aspirations for ever getting this down in written form as a book, because there are so many, you know, people that I sort of say, hey, you're talking about this, just listen to this podcast. And they're just not in listening mode or audio mode or whatever it is. And they would most definitely, this kind of approach to history, and there's a level of enthusiasm and a level of engagement in the now that feels very much relevant to even young people that I teach. So I've been teaching, you know, 20-year-olds for a long time. And I think this sense of history being so deeply important when we're studying psychology. You know, I would love to give people a few recommendations, but oftentimes they're thinking about written form. So that was a very long way to say, are you writing a book someday? Or are you able to just take this and put it in a transcript form and do a little editing? I don't think it's that far off, actually.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think It's a very good question, and it's something that sometimes keeps me up at night.
I'm sorry. it's like the dissertation question. Are you finished yet? You know, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I wrote a dissertation that was very long, and I had a great time. It was great fun. And it was a very different process and a very different kind of, you know, mode of thought to produce that. And I guess the trouble I have is I do have a couple of possible ideas of books, but it's really hard to switch your brain into that mode. And what I have found is that I'm able to work on a lecture or two, and then also on some days work on an article and say, all right, in some ways the scope is kind of similar. Even though the articles are very long, it's also like, I'm going to tackle some things and read them and then make an outline and pull out the things I want and make a 10,000 word article. And some things I've thought of are, one, just collecting those articles into a book, because at this point, it's probably enough material. Another is I really should write a book on like a new history of Freemasonry, which...
Yes.
Yeah. And the thing is, I sort of took initial steps towards making a proposal for that sort of a book, maybe up through 19th century, and pitching it to academic presses. And it's an extremely frustrating process. You basically have to write the whole book before you write it and jump through all kinds of hoops. And it's extremely aggravating. And once again, my friend Michael said, well, don't do that. Just write a popular press book. Just write a history of Freemasonry for a wider popular audience press.
Yep. Yep.
And I said, oh yeah, I guess you're right. And you know, the last person to do that was Jasper Ridley. Unless I missed something, it was Jasper Ridley who wrote The Freemasons, which is an okay book, which is mainly aimed at debunking sort of popular conspiracy theories about Masons and contains some perfectly okay history, but does not really have much social or political analysis, or certainly not the what I would want to do, the symbolic and ritual analysis. So I think that is something I have on my docket. And then another one would be basically taking the myths of the month that I've done and trying to make, I don't know, maybe a 20, 25 page chapter out of each one and put them into, basically put them into a book about myths, a book about myths that have survived, you know, to today. And kind of analyzing each one and maybe having comments about myth making in general, that maybe could make a book. So those are all things I've thought of. I don't know how that sounds to you.
I think that sounds fantastic. I just want you to do this. And I'm telling you that I think most of the work is already done is my thing, because as you're doing this podcast, it's so aimed at, well, it is. It's lecture format and aimed at making people understand. It's a very different thing than an academic chapter that is often not so much about communicating and understanding and more about sort of grandstanding knowledge and so on. And these are my fellow academics, so I'm allowed to say it. and I just think that your scholarship is very... uniquely translatable to a book that anyone would want to pick up, and yet still very rigorous in terms of, it's not just readable, but rigorous. So either one of those ideas I think are fantastic. And if you want help with any of it, I would be very happy to help in any way I can.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. I think it is the sort of thing I may need help with, because there's a certain degree of organizational, you know, to me, putting together one academic article and sending it to WMQ or Early American Studies is like, it takes all my brain power of like, what kind of footnotes do they want? And you know, like, what are the different, there are so many bureaucratic and logistical hoops. So Yeah, that might, I might take you up on that, and I really sure. appreciate your words of support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sam, there's another thing that I kind of wanted to ask, which is, you presented, so you've said history is everything that's not physics, basically, and you've got this quite procedural approach, you know, where you've got these kind of steps laid out of how you attack a new subject. But I'm very curious, like, is what you find when you apply this procedure, is it wildly different, or is all, you know, do you kind of come in and it's, you sort of know what to do, you get the lay of the land, and the procedure is somehow similar each time? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's pretty consistent for me at this point. The objects are maybe kind of the odd man out because I'm going about that a little differently. The concept of it is different, where I want to find an intriguing in, you know, I want to find something that's visually intriguing and that seems to have a story behind it. And then I try to make that branch out to as many different places as I can. You know, I want to know about the material. I want to know about the people who made it, the people who used it. Where is it? How did it end up there? And mm-hmm. I look at it as like, I don't know if I've said this on the podcast, but that I often think about holograms. When I was young, we once went to a hologram museum, and they had this huge hologram of like a unicorn, and you would see this unicorn jumping out at you. And then the curator pointed out, he cut off a little corner of it, and he said, "Hold this up to your eye, and you look at it up close, and you see the same unicorn. It's like embedded into the structure of the thing, and you see it at any scale. You zoom in, zoom out, you see the same image." And I think of these objects sort of like that. Like, no matter how tiny they are, you look up close and you see the whole story behind them. You see the world behind them. And so to me, those are very special, and they're very fun, because it's almost like a magic trick trying to see how much can you pull out of this one thing and how much can you surprise people. But so those are a little different. For me, it's like, all right, how do I follow all the trails and see what I can find? As opposed to basically all the others are about, all right, how do I take something that is like a black box and make a story and make a thread and a through line that carries you from A to Z, that carries you from, we're talking about Neolithic hunter-gatherers to we're talking about the Ashoka and the Maurya Empire, right? Mm-hmm. How did it get from A to B? And I want to make the story work. And for those, for basically all the others, the approach is pretty similar. And it tends to play out about the same way. And I will get into, for me, fundamentally, it's a narrative, but I will get into the conceptual issues and the conceptual problems when necessary, you know, when they are there and impossible to get around, when they're standing in the way, I think, of people understanding the story. And I guess with the Judaism one, that was sort of like a prototype, I guess, in that way, where I was like, I want to tell you where Judaism came from. But in order to do that, I have to get these ideas out of your mind. And I have to, you know, I have to switch. I have to rotate your point of view in order for you to see the story unfold and make sense.
I also want to ask you, so you read just an insane amount, it sounds like. Would you like to recommend any books or just anything that's moved you, influenced you? Yeah, whatever comes to mind, really.
That's funny. There are a lot of things that have influenced me. And in some ways, it's ironic because in different ways, they represent different approaches from what I'm doing. But nonetheless, I wouldn't do what I am doing now if I hadn't been exposed to them. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite books is Love in the Western World by Denis de Rougemont, who actually is a philosopher. And I, you know, I've mentioned this a couple of times to like academic advisors, and they were like, well, he's a philosopher, isn't he? And I'm like, yeah, but it's a great book. And that has definitely affected how I go about understanding and talking about, you know, Christianity, the social underpinnings, the social relationships of Christianity, art, literature. It's a really powerful book. If I read it again today, I'd probably pick apart a lot of the claims and say, nope. But nonetheless, at least one major central claim where he claims that the troubadour poetry served as an expression of Cathar theology, which sounds like a completely nuts claim initially from the historical perspective, but I think he really demonstrates it in this eye-opening way. And that has influenced how I've gone about trying to understand various things like Freemasonry and like, oh wait, you know, you can actually make a rigorous argument that about symbolic meanings and about hidden subtexts. Mm-hmm. There are such, subtext is a powerful part of life, and you have to be alive to it, I think, to understand history. So that would be a big one. Love in the Western World, or I think in French it's L'amour et l'Occident. And in a similar vein, Alasdair MacIntyre. I mean, you know, I'm gonna lay it out there. I love Alasdair MacIntyre. I'm a big fanboy. I wrote him a fan letter. Mm-hmm. And again, he's doing philosophy, but he's doing philosophy in a historical mode, you know, trying to illustrate, reconstruct and illustrate how thought has changed. And, you know, if I tried to write a book like that, I would do it a bit differently. But again, that's a huge influence on me. I mean, Three Rival Versions of Moral Enquiry. That's one of his lesser knowns, and it's based on lectures. You know, and a lot of these like awesome books that really stick with me are originally lectures that were put on the page. And Three Rival Versions of Moral Enquiry is a big one. What else was I thinking of? And also, and as for history, I'm going to be a little bit disloyal, unfortunately, which is my advisor, my main graduate advisor was Evan Haefeli, who is a really wonderful, rigorous scholar who like really is very meticulous about finding the sources and interpreting them, and was a really good advisor that way. But he co-wrote two books about the attack on Deerfield in the War of the Spanish Succession in 1703. I think I have that right. It was either 1702 or 1703. And they're very good books. But there is another book that deals with the attack on Deerfield called The Unredeemed Captive, which is fairly postmodern. I mean, it's very postmodern, but also very transparent about the sources he's using and drawing from in a way that was, I found very, very thrilling in a similar way, that he could focus in on the exact pieces of evidence and then make a really good argument about what the implications are, the hidden implications of those pieces of evidence, and puts together a really intriguing and powerful story. And I guess as someone who loves literature, that was really striking for me.
That's amazing. I have written those down. I have not read any of those, actually. Any film recommendations? That's my film? Final question. I'll give another chance to the others if they, I would love to know any movies you've liked or loved.
Oh, well, there are so many. But the One thing I definitely should say is that my favorite movie is Network.
Oh, and, yes.
Oh, Network.
It's a great film. Yeah.
I could do the monologues, the Howard Beale monologues, word for word. It's like Shakespeare. It's incredible. And so, so searing and so uncompromising.
Yeah.
And like crystalline, and it's like he somehow caught this shift in the ethos so quickly. I cannot believe that movie is 1976. It's like, how did he perceive?
How did he know that this is what? Yeah.
And, you know, and even watching it in like 2000, 2001, I was like, he anticipated the reality TV craze. And this sort of, you know, lurid, almost sadistic voyeurism of watching people fight with each other on camera. And he distilled it all so fast, as if he could see like 30 years ahead. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, now you say like 50 years ahead. And it's somehow it's prophetic. It's prophetic. And it,
absolutely.
And beautiful, beautiful. The language of it. So that's my favorite movie. There are many others I love for different reasons, but that would be the number one.
Mm-mm. Isabella or Zahi or anyone in the audience, would you like to come up? Otherwise, I'm thinking sort of last questions, wind down. Is that okay for you, Sam?
Yeah, sure. I'm having a great time. This is great. So I'm loath to close, but
okay. Well, we don't need to close yet.
No, but I do have things I should do eventually. So, you know, but if anyone wants to talk for a few more minutes, I'd be happy to.
Let's do it. Isabella. What...
The only thing I was going to say is, first of all, to thank you both. I really, really do appreciate this conversation. And I know I'm already like taking up too much time around this point, but see the whole point that you just mentioned around the lectures, a book around lectures and the one that you liked about McIntyre. That's exactly my point. Some of my favorite books are based on lectures. And I think there's a really interesting there's a little interesting tone based on books based on lectures that I think would be really, really fascinating to get from you at some point. So I'm just kind of doubling down on that recommendation and excitement about it.
Thank you.
Actually, one question, Sam. You know, my background is not history. But like it feels like the mode of the lecture is just much more important within the humanities than it is within the sciences. Do you think there's like something that like we miss when we write lectures or stuff like that that could make it seem more powerful than just y equals mx plus b? You plug in these and then you get something out kind of thing.
Well, you mean in physical sciences and mathematics?
Yeah.
Is that what
I feel like when I hear a lecture in humanities, it feels structured differently, much different than like when I take like an engineering course, like when I took, like even in the graduate degree courses, there was never really that kind of emphasis that this is all a part of something unless the professor really tried. And that was very rare just due to the nature of how academia is. I was just wondering if you have advice for like trying to like if I was to make a lecture, like what I can do to make it feel like it's something that you would want to learn from instead of just like, all right, here's what you need for the test kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, and I didn't take very many higher level sciences. I actually could have gotten away with taking zero at Brown, but I took a few, and one was physiology, and I found that was a survey course that was taught by several professors, right? Specialists in different fields. And the first one was on neuro, and she was so by far the best. And I learned the most, and it was the most exciting. And I think that she was fairly straightforward, but nonetheless, she presented the different parts and aspects as kind of like open problems or questions that she was then going to answer. right? It wasn't like you need to know X, you need to know Y. She presented it more like, how does the action potential get from one cell to the next? And why do these voltage gated ion channels matter? Why do they open or close? What does that do? You know, she presented it as sort of like a series of little mysteries or like a puzzle that the pieces had to fit into in the right order, right? It wasn't an accumulation of facts. It was more like a succession of questions that needed to be answered. At least that's roughly how I remember it. And because I remember moments of saying, I don't see how this channel opening or closing could cause this sort of wave of energy to go up a nerve. But she then step by step filled in the picture, right? So that the questions were answered. That, I think, to me, that made it like an experience and not a recitation, right? I don't know how much that relates to what people like me do in humanities, but, you know, when I'm narrating a narrative, that's sort of what a narrative is. A narrative is like a succession of unanswered questions that then have to be resolved piece by piece, step by step, until you get to the end point, until you get to some conclusion. And that's sort of, I think, how she, I remember her name was Zimmerman, and she, that's kind of how she did it. And she wasn't like gimmicky about it. It was just the way that she explained things. It was sort of natural to her. And I remember the point where I got it and I said, oh, how insane is that? That's how an action potential travels. And it happens so fast. It can go right from your fingertip to your brain in a fraction of a second. And the others were not as good. A couple of them were fine. But that's sort of all I can say to that. And, you know, people really like lectures on the history of science. Those seem to be popular. I've only done a couple. Many others make whole courses of them. And that's sort of what the history of science is, right? Is problems arising. A question is answered, but it raises another question. How do you tackle that one? What, and the next question that leads to, right? It's like a challenge or a journey. So that's really all I can say to that.
It's funny, because I actually, when I thought about what are good books that have come from lectures, the first two that came to mind were actually science books. And those for me were John von Neumann's The Computer and the Brain, which he was writing, I think, near the time that he died. It's an amazing book. Again, one of these prophetic books where he sort of, just before his death, kind of gathers everything that's known in neuroscience. And a lot of it turns out to be like decades before, you know, anyone knows that much about the brain, and he's just right about it. And then he also lays down what becomes like modern computing in that same book, which is just insane. And that was intended as lectures. And the other one, similar time frame, I think, no, it's earlier than that. Computer in the Brain was the 50s, I think, is Schrodinger's What is Life? And I don't know if you've ever, either of you have ever come across it, but it is an amazing book. It's a physicist saying, okay, what is, you know, just asking the question of what is life? So that may kind of align with what you were saying, Sam, about framing the science lecture as a question to be answered.
Yeah. I think, and so.
I think von Humboldt's Cosmos started as, that's going back to the 18th century or whatever, but I think that started as lectures as well. Is that right? No, 19th century, sorry.
Well, I mean, so many things, you know, in Hutton's Geology, it was, yes. It was first lectures, wasn't it? Was it at Glasgow? It's either Glasgow or Edinburgh. And, you know, very often that's where people are sort of just ready enough to put their new argument out. And then it has to become a book, and it can be a sort of a formative part of the process to order what they're trying to say in you know, in a way that gets across to an audience. And I think a lot of books probably would have been much better and more compelling if they'd had to do them as lectures first before writing the book. You know, there's a lot of dry stuff out there. But some of it is great too. But it's, you know, humans are are linguistic animals, and they like to talk to each other, and they like to hear each other. And, you know, I don't think it helps the written word to get too far from that.
I totally agree. The other one I did want to sort of plug is, it's more in philosophy than science, but it is philosophy of science, is Thomas Kuhn's Objectivity, Value Judgment, and Theory Choice, which I actually read on one of my podcasts, just because I was like, what would it be like to read a lecture, you know, and try and make it come to life or whatever. I love that podcast, but it's more like philosophy than it is science, I guess.
Yeah, well, and sometimes, you know, like I like the Order of Things by Foucault, and the Order of Things is like, I don't think I read most of it. I think I only read early parts of it, and I was like, okay, I get it. I see what you're doing. But it starts with Foucault saying, I would like to begin in the middle of a sentence, but since I can't do that, I will at least give you a complete sentence, and now I will just launch into what I'm trying to say. And it's like he's picking up on some sort of line of argument that he's already put forward somewhere else, and he's just continuing with it with the minimum of framing or introduction. And he's sort of trying to make a point, those sort of introductory framings like you see in a book can actually diminish the power of what you're saying, that they contain it within this sort of manageable genre and form. And he wants to resist that, which is, it's this classically cheeky Foucault move, but it sticks in your mind. You know, I remember it all these years later, and it helps to hammer down what he was trying to say. It really makes it more powerful.
Yes. And I kind of have a hot-ish take, a warm take, let's say, on this science, you know, writing thing about like who's revolutionary in science. And Darwin is one of them. And I feel like Darwin, he's so many things, but he is such a good communicator. He's such a good writer that it's almost like that he is foremost a writer and kind of generalist, and all the other stuff is like done by other people, basically. And, you know, Einstein comes across that way a little bit to me too, is that, you know, like, I not to say that they're only writers, but that if they weren't such good communicators, I think they would have failed, essentially, because I don't know if that's actually true, but it's just come across my mind at certain points just how important that communication is.
Yeah, well, I can again quote Divya Cherian, who could be so pithy, where at some point I sort of offhandedly said, I read some of The Order of Things and History of Sexuality, and I find that Foucault's style is quite readable, and you know, it's narrative, and it's not that hard to get into at all. And she said, you know, all major philosophical interventions are written in lucid, readable prose. I said, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. You know, if you don't have that gift, you're certainly not going to reach the same kind of audience.
The same audience,
you know? And,
yeah.
And philosophy, science, history—they're all literature. Ultimately, they're all we experience all of them as literature, and a lot of it, you know, their power depends a lot on their literary qualities, and I think that's certainly true with Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Zahi, what area are you working in? Or I think we lost Zahi.
Yeah. I think he is in robotics. I know he posts about robotics.
Yeah, maybe engineering is a bit different.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'll ask him. But I may have to look at this Neumann. I mean, maybe the last thing I should just comment on briefly is that this Yale Journal of Law and the Humanities asked me to write an essay about how history, well, how humanities can inform technology, law, and design to foster healthy democracy and discourse. So I've started working on that. And of course, you know, I can't resist the impulse to say, what do you mean by democracy? What do you mean by healthy discourse? let me deconstruct these premises that you're giving me. But I started trying to think about how to do that, how to kind of examine what do we mean by democracy? And it very quickly exploded because I thought about this painting of the House of Representatives from the 1820s that sort of shows the House in this very sort of ethereal light with people milling around. It's very open and freeform, but very serene, and these big neoclassical columns. And I thought, this seems like it captures something of what people think of as democracy, an American democracy. And then I remembered who painted it. It was Samuel F.B. Morse, who was a rabid anti-Catholic conspiracy theorist and wrote tracts about the Catholic conspiracy to take over America. And of course, invented the telegraph and spurred this whole sort of sensation, you know, this great hope and also panic about the power of instantaneous communication and the sense that people are all kind of merging, are going to merge into one sort of hive mind through these electronic connections. So I was like, oh my God, this one guy is like giving me everything. He's packing them all together in this one biography. And and I've been looking at that, and it's like too much. It's too much to contain. But the one other thing I'm trying to draw further beyond that, beyond Morse, is this sort of growing fear of machines and of automatons and simulacra, and this danger that the sort of the machine will come alive and will successfully mimic humans. Right. That's still the fear. Right. Right. The from. Golem. Yeah. Golem and Frankenstein. And yes. And I was thinking of Tales of Hoffman and Olympia.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Olympia.
Yeah. Yeah. And this idea, what if the machine can fool us and successfully mimic a human? And, you know, and as I was making notes, that story came up about the Google bro saying, oh no, my chat bot has come alive. It was like too perfect.
Yeah, just like the clockwork fears of
your... Yeah, yeah. What if the mechanical
what if my
Turk...
clock? Yeah, exactly. That's amazing. It's been an absolute pleasure, Sam. I've loved listening to you, and just love the podcast, and thanks for being available for this.
Thank you. I'm so glad we could put it together, and I hope everyone's been hearing me to the end here. My little purple lines have disappeared, but hopefully people have still been hearing me. And it's wonderful to hear from these people that I've seen, you know, commenting and posting for years in some instances, and yeah, so just spread the word, and did you say so? This should be recorded, and
this
be
is
like
recorded.
Okay, and there will be like a link and such.
Yeah, I'll get that over to
Great.
You. Yeah, so this will stay up on Twitter, and also we can get a file of it if in case there's anything we want to cut together later on.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having the idea, and it's been wonderful talking to you. It's you know, it's quite unreal. Sometimes I wonder if you're all automata and simulacra.
If we just come alive from the
the machine, the mind of the machine.
The machine is clicking like 1 in 1,000 times just to keep you at it, right?
Right, right. Yeah, beautiful. So thank you. Thank you, Brian. And thank you, everyone who joined. And tell friends, post, spread the word. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much.
Okay, and have a happy Independence Day to all who celebrate. Those of us in the colonies here.
Yes, you too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Bye, Sam.
Mm-hmm.